now. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Wednesday, time to talk about your health. And most fortuitously, a member of our panel is a lead author on a groundbreaking study that's getting a lot of attention. It is on using AI, artificial intelligence, to monitor patients' conditions, specifically signs that they're deteriorating, and to do that in time to intervene. And pardon me if I am getting too personal, but how round are you? We have talked many times about the use of BMI, body mass index, as a measure of overweight and obesity, and warnings about all the health hazards that result from that. Well, now there's another measure, body roundness index. I clicked on a calculator, and later on I'll tell you what I found, how it works. The numbers to call, 416-360-0740, toll free 1-866-740-4740.
Now time for The Medical Record.
And now I'd like to welcome Dr. Elisa Naiman, a family doctor in Toronto, Dr. Amol Verma, clinician scientist at St. Michael's Hospital, and Temerty Professor of AI Research and Education in Medicine, and Dr. Aaron Schimmer, the Director of Research at the Princess Margaret Cancer Center, as well as a staff physician and senior scientist. Hello, everyone. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Libby.
Let us begin with Dr. Verma. Tell us about your study.
Yeah, thanks, Libby. So we have been working on a tool that can use artificial intelligence to monitor all of the information that gets input into the hospital's electronic medical record routinely in the process of care. So when a nurse checks a patient's blood pressure or heart rate and inputs that information into the medical record system, we developed a tool that mines all of that information and generates an hourly prediction of which patients might be at risk of deteriorating. We know that when adults are hospitalized for medical or surgical problems, they're quite unwell, and a proportion of patients, about 5 to 10%, will become so sick in hospital that they might need intensive care or they might die. And predicting who might deteriorate is one of the hardest things for clinicians to do. So we developed this AI tool that can give us an early warning signal that can trigger for nurses and doctors the patients that might be at risk of deteriorating, so that, as you said in your introduction, we can intervene earlier. We can deliver some life-saving treatments like antibiotics, or in cases where the deaths cannot be avoided, we can ease suffering. We can intervene early with good, high-quality palliative care. And so we were really excited to see that after we deployed this tool in our hospital at St. Michael's, we saw a 26% reduction in unexpected deaths compared to the time period before the tool was implemented.
Okay, here's some questions. If these are things that you monitor anyway, like blood pressure, heart rate, whatever, why is it so hard to predict for a human as opposed to the AI?
Well, it's hard for everyone to predict which is the first point. It's hard to know what's going to happen in the future, right? And so it's actually interesting that AI is about the same accuracy as doctors and nurses at predicting what's going to happen in the future, but the predictions are different. So the AI will flag a certain set of patients, and the doctors and nurses flag a different set of patients. And when we combine the AI predictions and the doctors and nurse predictions together, you actually get better recognition of all the patients. So that's quite interesting. And it's really
how are they the same if they flag different patients as being at risk?
Well, neither flags everyone. Right. So neither humans, sort of doctors and nurses, nor the AI system capture every single patient. Neither is perfectly accurate, but the AI will flag a proportion of patients, let's say like 50 to 60% of the patients who will have this outcome. And the doctors and nurses flag a different 50 to 60%. There's some overlap, but not perfect, which means if you combine them together, actually what we see in our study. You see a 16% improvement in the identification of high-risk patients, if that makes sense. So you're trying to combine the computer's information and the doctor's information. And the way we train the doctors and the nurses is to say, look, if you think that a patient is high risk, trust your gut. But if the AI thinks that a patient is high risk and you don't, you should trust the AI. So it's kind of the combination of both.
And again, before we move to our other panelists, what is being measured here? It's the heart rate. What else?
Yeah, so it takes about 100 different inputs. So things like heart rate, blood pressure, temperature, but also all of the different laboratory test results and other other things that get sort of recorded in your electronic medical record routinely when you are admitted to a hospital. And you know, the other reason that this tool is really helpful, Libby, is that it's not physically possible for a doctor or a nurse to have eyes on every patient all the time, right? We just can't work in parallel that way. Whereas this tool can. The tool can watch every patient at all times and provide an hourly update so that it can signal for the clinicians earlier which patients to focus on.
Dr. Schimmer, I mean, we've talked a lot here about AI being useful in medical practice in general and in cancer treatment as well. So what's your reaction to this, and can you see uses for it in what you do every day?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think we are really on the cusp of a revolution in medicine about how we care for our patients as we incorporate artificial intelligence. And you should know, Toronto is actually one of the true world leaders in this, at Princess Margaret and also certainly at St. Mike's with Dr. Verma. And we are using AI in the care of our cancer patients. AI being used really in two ways. One, similar to what you've heard, where AI can take massive amounts of data, hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of data points, and analyze them. And yes, of course, a person could do that too, but you know, going through a million data points is going to be difficult and time-consuming. AI can do that quite quickly. The other very exciting application of AI is its ability to analyze images, so x-rays, CAT scan-type images, and be able to see things that the radiologist or the doctor might not otherwise be able to see with the naked eye. And so, for example, a recent study published from Princess Margaret by Dr. Habe Kanes showed that by using AI and analysis of CAT scan images in patients with cancer of the cervix, they could predict the response rates to standard chemotherapy and decide who should and shouldn't get the standard therapy.
Is there a danger or a possibility that AI will put radiologists or other types of medical specialists out of business?
I don't think it's so much that they're going to make radiologists or pathologists obsolete. What I hope is that it will help them make diagnoses better and quicker and allow them to do more things for the patients. I think we're always going to need radiologists. Hopefully, though, that the AI can make their work more efficient.
Alisa, does this drill down to the family doctor in the clinic at all?
It does. So one application that I've used now is sometimes what I'll do is I'll take a picture of a patient's rash, and there's an application within Google that you can upload the picture of any dermatological condition. That's how I've used it, and it will come up with examples of what it could be, and oftentimes it will help to narrow down a diagnosis without having to refer somebody to a dermatologist and the patient having to wait months to get their appointment. So I've started doing that with some patients. And then currently the government is doing a pilot study of looking about using AI technology as a scribe. So we've all heard in the media about how 19 hours per week of a family doctor's time is spent not caring for a patient and doing administrative work. And that by using AI, especially for charting, that it will make things more efficient and that more time can be spent on patient care. So the government is currently doing a study, and there's different products that are available right now. And actually in the last couple of weeks, I've started researching it to see which one I feel would integrate well within my EMR system. And hopefully by the end of the year, we'll be able to trial some AI software so that it will help and make my job more efficient so that I can spend less time documenting and more time seeing patients.
Is that a federal government study or a provincial government study?
A provincial government. So the Ontario government in the spring announced that they were piloting, it's called AI Scribe, and they're trialing it in certain family practice offices to see whether or not it makes things more efficient.
Very interesting. I guess there's this, I don't know if you would call it a tension, but on the one hand, you have an increased use of technology, which everybody says is a major way to help the healthcare system. But on the other hand, there is the human touch, and medicine is still very much an art, Dr. Verma.
Yeah, I think that part of the art, hopefully, of incorporating these technologies will be to do so in a way that improves our ability to deliver very humanistic healthcare. You know, the AI Scribe tool is a good example of how, you know, I think what we've lived through is the first generation of technologies that came with digitizing our healthcare system, right? And so as a consequence, a lot of our clinical interactions now, our clinicians are tethered to the computer screen and they're typing. And, you know, that took us away from each other, right? From our patients and put our attention on the screen. And my hope is that some of these new technologies actually help us go back to face-to-face interactions, free up some more time for the humanistic aspects of care. I will say that I don't think it just will happen naturally on its own. I think it's really important that clinicians, that patients, that caregivers and loved ones of patients, that we are very active in helping design and advocate for solutions that do that, that make care more compassionate and more humanistic, and raise our voices around that. Because if we don't do that, we might end up with another suite of technologies that are burdensome, that are depersonalizing. So it's important. I think we have an important role to play in shaping this future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Let's move along to the body roundness index. Alisa, what's your take on that?
I hate BMI. I don't think it's a very good measure on an individual level. It seems that everybody knows about it. I think its utility is probably more on a population level because people do have differences in their body composition that impacts things. You could have somebody who is quite muscular who will weigh more than somebody who isn't, and they will have a BMI that makes them in a higher level than what their true risk will be. So I think tools that are being developed that help to take into account body composition, and the one that you mentioned includes abdominal circumference, and some of them also include hip circumference to get a sense of what your fat is around your abdomen, because we know that visceral fat is the fat that's the dangerous fat. It's not the fat that you have on your hips. People don't like it, but it's metabolically not active and doesn't cause problems. But it's that fat that's around your waist that causes problems. It releases inflammatory cytokines. It leads to cardiovascular disease, insulin sensitivity. And so that really becomes the more important aspect in terms of your health. And I, you know, as a female practitioner, I have a lot of female patients, and weight, unfortunately, is a very touchy subject for people. And people are aware of what their BMI would be, and it's very distressing, so much so that people won't stand on a scale when they come in for an appointment.
Sounds very familiar. Have you tried this BRI? Have you tried to give it to patients? Have you tried it yourself?
No, I actually didn't know about it until yesterday, and I do have to take my my measurements today, and I will plug it in. I took a look at it, but I think that it just gives a better indication of what your risk will be. I'm somebody who is more muscular than other people, and so my BMI would be higher than what people would think. And it's honestly just because of the amount of muscle that I have.
Ooh.
And so I really reinforce, we've talked about this before on all my patients, especially my female patients, that you really do have to build your muscle strength as you age. And it's very important. and we're starting to get through now to younger generations that they understand the importance of being strong when you're young and putting on that mask so that it helps you when you're older. So I think this really will be such a huge change. What's interesting is that when I have to give information for people for their life insurance, that one of the measurements is actually BMI.
Oh, really?
I didn't. Yeah, and hopefully things will change, that we get to understand that risk is actually not just based on your height and your weight, but where you have your fat within your body.
Dr. Schimmer, Aaron, I mean, we know, or I've seen studies that obesity is a big risk for cancer. And so it's problematic for people who are muscular, the old BMI. The other criticism is that it was developed only with basically white men, and that it is very misleading, especially for a lot of African Americans, African Canadians. So have you come across this BRI or used it in any way?
So I must also say that it's not a measurement that I use routinely, but I would say that, you know, we routinely measure patients' heights and weights. And in fact, every patient that comes to our clinic is getting their weight measured. And the reason that we're so obsessed about measuring weight in the cancer clinics is that many, if not most, of the cancer drugs that we give are dosed based on a formula that includes height and weight. Now, I would argue that it may be possible to refine that measurement but often when we dose and we measure height and weight, it's because the chemotherapy drugs will diffuse throughout the mass of the body. And so it's important to understand what that person's mass is. But yes, you probably could get more accurate if you knew how much of that mass was fat and how much of that was muscle. We also routinely measure patients' weights because unintentional weight loss, insignificant unintentional weight loss, can be a concerning sign when patient has or is suspected to have cancer. And we're learning more and more these days about the mechanisms, about why is it that obesity or excess weight is a risk factor or causative for diseases such as cancer.
Amol, you know, I see a lot of, especially men, as they get older, and even I know some men who exercise regularly, but huge guts, which presumably are dangerous. I mean, I think that having a sense of that is probably good, but you know, they seem to get bigger guts than women.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the anecdotal like evidence of whose guts grow larger, but I will say that that I think your point is right, and it's what Dr. Neiman mentioned before, which is that we know that abdominal fat that gathers near the organs, the visceral fat, it gathers near our organs in our abdomen, is really what we're worried about when we talk about metabolic risk going forward. And I will say two things. One is, you know, in my world, we also, there are two things that are true about BMI. So the first is that pretty much every clinician thinks it's useless. At the same time, we use it for important decisions, like, for example, whether someone is eligible for certain kinds of bariatric surgery or certain kinds of treatments. And so I think it's great that the scientific world is trying to overcome BMI with better indices. And it's really important that that gets translated into the way we deliver clinical care for all the reasons that, you know, we've talked about many times on this program.
You're telling me something I didn't know. So BMI is used to determine if somebody can get bariatric surgery, and what's the cutoff? Does it have to be higher or does it have to be lower? Please tell me about that.
Yes, in some cases so some of the randomized trials that initially were testing bariatric surgery looked at certain extreme levels of BMI, so BMI is greater than 40 or in some cases above 35 with other risk factors as inclusion criteria for the studies for different kinds of bariatric surgery. And so our evidence is sort of anchored around that measurement, and it speaks to how, you know, there's real value in having a numeric measurement because, for example, in a randomized trial, it allows you to, in a simple way, sort of standardize entry criteria. If you're thinking about how to run a program, it's difficult to say who's eligible or ineligible for a certain kind of therapy if you don't have a simple metric. So in that, you can understand why a simple metric like BMI kind of propagated throughout healthcare in a variety of different ways. The problem, of course, is when those metrics are flawed. And so I think it's really important that we come to defining new metrics. These kinds of summary quantitative metrics are really valuable and important. So yeah, Libby, that's why in some cases there are actually treatment decisions that are informed by people's BMI, even though we know it's not an ideal metric, and hopefully we can get to better metrics going forward.
Well, there are numbers. I'm looking at the study. I can't find the link. I clicked on the link, and of course now I can't find it because it's complicated. Like, I don't think you can calculate your own BRI. So all I had to put in was my height and my weight. So 6.9 and up, and that is the roundest body. So those are the risks. So there would be a number attached to that, but I'm thinking it probably takes a lot to convince, if it's insurance companies and the decision makers for surgery, like changing that metric would be a big deal proposition, right?
So let me.
Yeah,
just
I think it's hard to move people off of embedded practice. Sorry, go ahead, Dr. Naiman.
No, I was just going to say that for the Ontario Bariatric Network, so that's how you have to get referred to have bariatric surgery within the province, the cutoff is either a BMI of over 40 or 35 with an additional condition, hypertension, heart disease, sleep apnea, osteoarthritis. So 35 plus an additional condition or 40 and above in order to qualify.
Okay, well, we'll see if anything changes on that. Yeah, I mean, the other thing is I'm assuming that if you have a high BMI because you're extremely muscular, then you're not looking for bariatric surgery anyway. I want to move on to another topic that I think is very timely. So in BC, they made involuntary commitment for people with mental health conditions and addiction conditions. I just want to know what you think of that. I mean, it's not a blanket thing, but they've kind of given up on the approaches of harm reduction and people with mental illness having agency. Dr. Schimmer, Aaron, do you have a view of that?
Well, I think there's the medical view that addiction is a disease similar to many other diseases, and patients with addiction need treatment, and there are a number of effective medical treatments that one can do for patients with opioid addiction, and there's counseling and behavioral modifications. Where one does that, how one does that, and whether one should involuntarily detain people is perhaps more of a political issue than it is a medical issue. But, you know, I think that there is clearly precedent where patients who, because of psychiatric disease, are a danger to themselves or a danger to others, we have precedent that those patients can be involuntarily held. You can not necessarily treat them, but they can be involuntarily held as long as they're a danger to themselves and others. And I think it's that same principle that was being applied in this case.
Well, they can only be held for 48 hours. Amal, do you have a view of that?
Yeah, I mean, being a practitioner here in Ontario, I'm quite
at
familiar with the Ontario laws over the more than the BC specific laws, but they're similar. And what I would say is that confinement or involuntary care for patients is a very important responsibility that healthcare practitioners do not take lightly and is very tightly medico-legally regulated. And so in Ontario, we have very strict criteria over, you know, who can be hospitalized involuntarily and why. And it usually involves consultation with a psychiatrist. There's an appeals process. And I would say that the process here in Ontario, you know, this kind of process is pretty rarely applied for people with addictions issues alone. And it's more, you know, if they're a danger to themselves or others for a combination of other psychiatric issues. I would say in rare cases, you know, I've been practicing internal medicine now for about a decade or more. And we, you know, frequently care for patients who do require this kind of involuntary care in partnership with our psychiatry colleagues. I could count on the number on my hand, the number of times that it's been just an addictions related issue. So what I would say is that this announcement, which also I will say included funding for more mental health beds, which was sort of buried in there. I think the messaging around this announcement probably smacks a little bit of pre-election politicking more than it does about specific policy. But what I think is important for people to know is that, you know, this part of involuntary care for people with serious mental illness is an important part of our healthcare system that's really carefully and judiciously applied.
Dr. Naiman, I'm assuming that you certainly probably have people who are family members of people with those issues, though. So what do you make of this move in BC?
I agree with my colleagues. I think that a lot of this is probably politically motivated. I have patients who have addictions and family members who have to deal with it and often have to deal with the consequences of the addiction. And I always say to them, we can't force them to go into to receive therapy, that they have to really be willing and want to do it. And it's extremely difficult and very hard for family members to have to go through this. And here, I think in Ontario, we've had circumstances and it's been in the media where there's been people with mental health who've committed violent crime and they're in hospital as opposed to being within a jail system. So I think that there is benefit for people to be properly receive treatment, but it just seems like this is very political right now. That there was a study that was mentioned that people who are involuntarily admitted, that they have a very high rate of death post-discharge. And I really think that we do have to figure out how we can get to the root of people's problems, their addictions, their mental health, try to get people the support and build from that.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thank you very much, and we will talk again soon. Thanks, Dr. Aaron Shimmer, Dr. Elisa Naiman, and Dr. Amal Verma. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, we are taking a break. When we come back, more controversy over that film, Russia at War. And we'll talk to two perspectives on that when we come back after the break.